So we are now on day three of our three-day retreat on full awareness of the breath. The Dharma brother Wes had to leave. We think we're going to be here forever. We think we can just go on and on with our habitual patterns. We think we can always really apply ourselves to the practice of liberation. When I get all these other things in my life straightened out or out of the way, and then life happens. It's not so far away for any of us. If it's not going to happen in us, it'll happen with those around us. That's just the nature of things. It is because of that, that going back 2,500 years to the Buddha himself, being mindful of impermanence is considered one of the key meditations, practices of mindfulness that one can do. It breaks through the delusion of permanence that we all live in. Big time wrong view. Not only will we not be here forever, we may not be here for another few hours. Just the way it is. Knowing that is not meant to increase our anxieties. It is to liberate ourselves from our anxieties. Our anxieties are all based on the future. We think we're going to have a future. And we think we know how it's going to unfold. And we worry that it may not unfold the way we think it's going to unfold. We don't have a clue. But in our conceit and arrogance, we think we do. It's so sad, isn't it? That we spend so much time worrying and concerned about the future and other people's futures. And one, we have no power to control it. Two, we have no special extrasensory perception to accurately see it. And three, it is robbing us of living a meaningful life for right now. So when we hear about sickness, when we hear about death, when we hear about change, when we hear about significant things happening to people, at the same time that our hearts go out to them as compassionate individuals, there should also be that moment of reflection, that stopping, that capacity to be present to what is occurring in reality and label it correctly. This is impermanence. This is the law of change. As we say in the Five Remembrances, I and everybody I know are subject to it. We will all be parted from everything. We'll be parted from our loved ones, we'll be parted from our bodies, we'll be parted from our youth, we'll be parted from our health, on and on and on. That's not morbidity. That is just reality. A good practitioner is somebody who knows all that and who has the capacity for happiness. For joy. Ordinary people look at those facts of reality and it scares them, or angers them, frustrates them, saddens them. Or they just live in denial. I don't talk about that. I don't want to look at that. I don't want to deal with it. So how can a practitioner look it square in the face and be happy, be joyous? Because the practitioner is not looking for their happiness in the world of change, in the world of impermanence. Fundamental teaching of Buddha. We know that within the world of change there is something that is changeless. What is it? We practice. Buddhist teachings, the practices, are all pointing us in the direction of liberation. Now, the problem is, we can't get on the New York subway just with that. We gotta pay the fare. People in the sharing yesterday saying it was a wonderful Dharma talk. So what? Big deal. Who cares? The only thing we should care about is, did I take it in? Did I digest it? And in my practice, is my practice different? Dharma is food. And it's good food. It's nutritious food. It's healthy food. It's healing food. But if we don't take it in, we don't digest it fully, so it can be absorbed throughout the body-mind, we won't get its benefits. Please remember. Any bit of Dharma that is meaningful to you, well, I just, that was great. Good words. Beautiful Dharma talk. Who cares? Okay. It only matters when you digest it. That becomes meaningful. I am continually struck, like I was the first time, by superiority complex, inferiority complex, inequality complex. I think that is very helpful for us in looking at egocentricity, which we know is a fundamental issue for all of us. It's a very unique way of looking at it. For example, and again, everything is simple. But unfortunately, we bring the complexity of our issues, of our projections, of our mental formations to the simplicity of reality. So if we have some self-awareness and capability to hold up a mirror so we can see somewhat objectively what we're doing, we have the possibility of liberating ourselves. For example, something as simple, I know it's the end of the retreat, something as simple as, let's just say, the commitments we make at the beginning of retreat, such as what? Such as we're going to be silent. Now, is that very hard to understand? This is a silent retreat. No talking. And yet, how many can sit here today and say they haven't talked during retreat? Now, why have you talked? I would say you talk because either you have a superiority complex, which is what? I'm unique. The rules don't count for me, right? They don't count for everybody else. But I'm special. I have a special reason why I can talk. So you have, your ego has a superiority complex. Or else perhaps your ego has an inferiority complex. It's too difficult for me. It's too hard for me. I'm just a little guy. I can't remain sound, too difficult, too hard to the big people. Inferiority complex. Or else inequality complex. Like, I saw so-and-so talking. If they can talk, I can talk. I mean, aren't I as good as them? The rule is what? If there's no self, that's easy. But if there's a superiority complex, you think you're unique, you're singularly unique and special, the world don't apply to you. Or else you think you're less than, or else you think you're absolutely equal. You're looking to break the rule, right? Other people cheat on their income taxes, so can I. Right? I just saw something go off the highway, they were going 90 miles an hour. So can I. So, when it seems that way, we realize it is not so subtle, is it? And it is interesting how we could go from step by step about what we bring. Our ego just comes into something very simple, and it distorts. It always distorts in terms of its own formations. If you want to continue to live in those metaphors, and I'm only saying that because if you do it here, you are doing it everywhere. There's nothing special here. It's just another situation for me to play itself out. If we are serious about non-self for sinners, we'll use every opportunity to develop non-self, to soften the tyranny of self. And I assure you, self is smarter than you. Clever. Has the capability of distorting, rationalizing. you know, right? I mean, people do all kinds of monstrous crimes and think they're helping people. Right? So, that's why, to have a Dharma. Number two. First hindrance was belief in self. Second hindrance was what? Doubt. Hesitation in terms of Dharma, the path, the way. If you have a way, you follow it. That's all. It's as simple as this. You have a way, follow it. You know, if you have a good teacher and you're in a class and your teacher says, this is what you need to do, right? You know, these are the chapters you got to read, and this is the, you know, the papers you got to write, and this is the thesis you need to do, and this is the study you got to do. You know, do it. But the ego is always, he's got an angle. She's got an angle. So he's going to do it her way, his way. You know, in the AA program, and I mean to say, I'm not in the AA program, but I have great respect for it, and know many people in. First thing the alcoholic's got to do is what? If they're going to get sober and go on their road to recovery, they have to what? What? Admit they're what?
Powerless
over what? So you got to admit they're what? I'm an alcoholic. From that, everything flows. From that willingness to come out of the closet and publicly state, I have a significant problem that I have no ability to solve on my own. From that, everything flows. Oh, so therefore I need what? I need help. I need a program. I need steps to follow, right? So I can get healthy. I need a program to follow it. I need a community of people to support me as I follow. I just got to keep showing up. And if I show up, there's a good chance I can get healthy. But, you know, not everybody follows the program. For a lot of people, it takes them a long time just to admit that they're not healthy. It's very important, again, and this is not inferior. You know, there's some people who love this kind of, oh, I'm the sickest of the sick. You know, I'll just enumerate to you all my shortcomings. It's not like that. If you're sick, if you're very sick, what do you need? You need to go to the doctor, don't you? Don't you? Because hopefully the doctor is somebody who has spent many years training themselves in diagnosing, understanding, sick, and helping people get well. Well, this is at its best. Right? So we're doctors. Now let me just say something to you. If you go to the doctor and you're in the waiting room, it's a crowded waiting room, right? Filled with who? Sick people just like ourselves. Are you going to start asking people in the waiting room for medical advice? Right? Why not, Charlie?
They're all sick too.
But you know what? You're going to find people in that waiting room who are going to start dispensing medical advice to you. Huh? I mean, when we step back, we go, there's something bizarre about me. That's why there are Buddhas. That's why there are masters. That's why there are teachers. So we can relax. So we can go to them, we can tell them our symptoms, where we're sick, we can get the prescription, we can get the protocols, we can go home, we can take the medicine, and hopefully we will get well. If it's good medicine, we will get well. Dharma is good medicine, retreat is good medicine, the schedule is good medicine, the commitment is a good medicine. It's all good medicine. We have to take it. There's a wonderful word that's very meaningful to me. The word is impeccable. Anybody know what impeccable means?
Without any blemish.
Without any blemish. Sitting here today at the end of the retreat, who of us can say, I have been impeccable? Impeccable. Honorable. I have practiced with great sincerity and integrity for the past 3 days. Not easy, is it? Forget it. But can you know how good we would feel, each of us, if we could say yes? My practice of these ways has been impeccable. It doesn't mean, you know, I got every breath mindfully. But in that, I was sincerely practicing to the best of my ability. I gave 100%. No matter how many times I fell down, I just picked myself back. No matter how many times I strayed, I just took myself back. No matter how many impulses wanted to take me this way or that way, I let them go. Because I wanted to pick up, practice the Buddha's way. Because I remember the first morning of retreat when Fred was reading about the Buddha and his assembly. About how when he looked over his assembly after 3 weeks, he said to them, well done. What wonderful practitioners. What wonderful fruit is ripening here. Let's stay another one. We're having such a good time. We're going to ripen some more. That's our model, friends. If you can have models in life, have models that raise you up. Show you the higher bar. We may not get over it yet, but at least we are inspired. Please, when you read these teachings on your own, read them that way. You decide you want to be that one disciple. The Buddha, that one, you know, today is more of a transmission, right? In the transmission, we say what? You are now a student of the Enlightened One. You're a student of the Buddha. You have now entered the Buddha's family. That should be meaningful. This is an ancient family. You go through the same ceremony that the first students of the Buddha went through. Same exact. And the word may be a little different, but same thing. You know, the medicine is given us. Those of you who follow Thich Nhat Hanh, you know the medicine is spoon-fed us. For a guy who spends 30 or 40 years digesting, chewing up, and then like the mother bird, and what's the word for that? Mm-hmm. But there's like a word for that stuff. It's all chewed up and, you know, reduced. What? I don't know, there's some word I made it. It's like that. Poor guy makes it so easy for us. I
especially when I was in Anjan, I went to Chris was there, Jacqueline was there, we're in Hanoi 2 years ago for a retreat with Thai, and I had an opportunity to go see him, and I hadn't seen him probably in 10 years. And this was toward the end of the retreat. And one of the first things he said to me was, you may be wondering why I'm teaching the same exact thing that I taught 10, 20, 30 years ago. Because people still don't practice it. They still don't practice it. So I gotta, you know, I just gotta keep so patient, isn't it? So I love it. Putting it out. Why? Why the same stuff? Because, you know, they still haven't gotten it. First of all, again, everything is in these little incidents. I mean, this is the revelation of Dharma and teachings. First of all, I want to thank all the people who are willing to expose their confusion, their greed, their attachments, their issues around food. I think it's very healthy. You know, there are a lot of communities where, spiritual communities, where you only kind of tell the good stuff. Everybody's kind of trying to look good. To me, those aren't very healthy communities because a lot is just wallpapered over. I think a very healthy community is a community where we can share our successes and share our failures, share our strong points, share our weak points, without attachment. You see, a lot of us, we are very attached to our stuff, especially our bad stuff, you know what I mean? You know, we want to keep it private, just for me. You know, keep it just for me, secretly. Why keep a secret about, you know, garbage? Right? Why hold on to it? You know, I would say, you know, here's my garbage, brothers and sisters. Can anybody help me in transforming it? I mean, that's healthy. That's going, I have garbage, but I know it's garbage. I know it kind of stinks, you know what I mean? And rather than kind of storing up in my pockets, you know what I mean, and carrying around in my suitcase where nobody can see it, I want to say to my teachers, to my spiritual friends, you know, I got this writing that I travel around with. Please help me. Because for some reason on my own, I don't seem able to turn it into compost. I don't know how to transform it. I think I'm doing it, but it keeps thinking. So help me. So yesterday people were going to, around the Browning issue. And again, even though several spoke, touch something deep. I'm sure there were many more little brownies in this room that people were not talking about. It is an issue of Dharma. It's a brownie issue. And the Dharma has a lot to say about brownies. I wouldn't even get into that the brownies were really a chocolate cake. I mean, that's just like a primary delusion. I've not seen the reality that's in front of you. I mean, we'll leave that for another Dharma talk. We'll deal with how it relates to our sutra. Because it really relates to what we're saying, I think yesterday or the day before, is are we going to keep cutting the leaves, cutting back the branches, or are we going to get to the root of things? Right? So we all have issues around food, sweets, right? And that a lot was presented. And again, at that level, obviously, you know, things can be dealt with, worked through, whatever. But it doesn't uproot it. So how does one look more deeply in this? the Dhamma. Sutra and mindfulness. What does it say? With my eyes, I see an object. It's brown. It's about this big. It has a name. My eyes see it. Maybe my nose is very sensitive. It smells it. And my mind immediately labels it. For many of you, it was what? Positive, negative, neutral. Positive. Want the truth? For me, it was neutral. Why? I'm just not into sweets. And probably, if it wasn't neutral, it would be negative, because I don't like chocolate. I know. But can you see? I mean, that's just, I'm just saying. So for me, it was a non-issue. But for many people, based on sight and based on labeling, there is a what? A positive response. Which, and when there's a positive response, there's what? A moving toward. Okay. So it's very simple. But very quickly, as we are today, and we won't hear more today, there was elaboration. In the world of perceptions and views and mental formations, there's lots of positives and negatives going on with lots of individuals around sweets, sugars, or chocolate, right? So what do we use? So there's on one side there's a grasping. The mind wants to move toward, make contact, constrict, grasp, make a story, right? Struggle, and then there's what? A struggle. Take it, don't take it. Eat it here, eat it upstairs. Eat it now, eat it later. Take one, take two. You know? Brothers and sisters, if you do this around little pieces of chocolate, what are we going to do with the big stuff? So, where are we dealing? What do we deal with it out here, or it's now become a struggle, or do we just deal with it here? Positive response, seeing, you know, moves toward it, something intervenes. I'm a diabetic, I'm more sugar, I don't know, that's not really good for me, I'm trying to cut down, so, right? Now there's a little bit of a struggle, right? Let it go. That's our practice, let it go. Our practice is what? Well, before we get to freedom, it's calmness. Developing a calm, unified mind. If there's struggle in the mind between the one who wants this and the one who wants that, it's good, it's bad, now, later, one, two, three, four, you know, there's struggle. So there's no longer unity in the mind. There is not disunity. There's no longer calmness in the mind, there's agitation. Just let it go. When it moves into conflict, when it moves into agitation, when it moves into struggle, let it go. What's the big deal? Again, this is what I was trying to say about the Dhamma. That's why I'm very grateful for this. It shows us if we can train ourselves to be mindful of what's going on at the very base. Now, there is just a, you know, pleasurable response. You know, we have good associations with sweets or chocolate or whatever. We see it, but another intervener, a little bit of a struggle. Why struggle? Is that big a deal? You know, on the other side of things, people know that we look at. In the Buddhist tradition, especially in the monastic tradition, like, let's say, in terms of a monastics, male and female, in terms of desire and lust, you know, which are obviously, if you're going the celibate road, lusting for other people, sexual objects, is not good. because you're not allowed to go there.
So we know that going back to the time of the Buddha, people would deconstruct the beauty of the desired object. So, you know, I'm very attracted to Dave over here. And, you know, but it's disturbing my meditation and my relationship with Angie. You know what I mean? For lots of reasons. So, I gotta work on it a little bit. So you know, now Dave appears to me as this beautiful, desirable object. So what can I do? I could begin to imagine Dave, you know, sick. Phlegm coming out of him, his nose is running, he's pale, he's coughing, you know, right? Desirable? Not so much anymore. Right? Or I can kind of go, well, you know, let me take Dave apart, right? He looks good out here, but, you know, I mean, let me look at his liver, his spleen, his digestive system, and all the stuff that's in it, his elimination system, right? You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Can you see all of a sudden I'm losing my attraction? and that's actually how monks and nuns do it. You know, just kind of revealing often the superficiality of our desire, because we don't look deeper. We just see the surface. And a lot of it's conditioned. People would also do it, you know, monks, they would often do it in terms of their own body to overcome their own attachments. To their own body. There is a thing there that we're calling a brownie, but it's really a piece of chocolate cake. But how could we deconstruct it? So we would put, you know, put a little white flour over here, put a little sugar over here, put a little beat up egg over here, put a little cocoa over here. Right, and you have, you know, four or five pies. Attracted? Mm-hmm. You're going to scoop it up and eat it? No. Because you put it together, I got to have some of that. Well, it's just that. It's just what it really was. Why is it so attractive? Why must you have it? Why must you have it to the point that it unsettles your mind? It causes conflict. So that's another way. You know, we can deconstruct the object of that which we see, it seems so attractive to us, to see more deeply what it is. So again, even these little things, like, so go down in the annals of our community history, but even the brownie incident. It so disturbed the harmony and well-being of our community. we can see it's an opportunity for fairly deep practice, isn't it? Mm. And fairly deep practice, just in those little things. And if we have the capability in our life, as these things come up, and they constantly come up, right? Because we are lay people, right? Which means we do not live in totally simple, austere, ascetic environment. We live with lots of things, you know, right? Coffee stores and gelato stores and flavors and choices, and, you know. So it's much more obvious that our attraction aversion will be stimulated. And the Buddha teaching from 2,500 years ago is helpful. Very helpful and helpful in helping us be free of the kind of struggle and conflict that can occur. But having said that, I want to get a little bit into the sutra. And coming back to the doctor analogy, how do we know that we're sick? And how do we know that we're getting well? Where we left off is the sutra with the five hindrances. And the five hindrances, as we said, is relating to stages of ripening, spiritual ripening. I think our one very good yardstick for us to look at, you know, just how sick am I? You know, do I have all the ten? You know, it's like a,
again, like, you know, it's like making a medical diagnosis, you know. To get this diagnosis, you need these five symptoms, and you got all five of them. Right? So you qualify. You only have three. So you may have a milder case, or you may, it may be something else. But when you got all five, based on historical data, it's a pretty good guess. That's what you got. Right? Now, here we have 10. So remember, the first is caught in the wrong view of self, which means that I believe there is such a thing as a permanent self-existent self in me and others. Second is doubt, hesitation. Primarily, it's about the path, but also, as we heard in the sermon this morning, and especially in traditions like the Zen tradition, the Dzogchen Great Perfection tradition, traditions that are very clearly about awakening. That to doubt your capacity to awaken, to doubt your capacity to be liberated, to doubt your capacity that you have the capabilities of liberating yourself, is to have this doubt, which is a hindrance to awakening. Now, then we talked about superstitious prohibitions, rituals. We talked about craving. Remember, we left off the craving because that clearly goes from the first, which is pleasure. Pleasurable sensation, movement toward, grasping on, craving, wanting, needing, etc. Now, the fifth one is, as can be imagined, is the other side, which is hatred, yeah, aversion, usually manifesting as hatred and anger. Why do we get angry? Because things that we don't want to be happening are happening. Right? We have an aversion to this whatever, this feeling, this sensation, this emotion, this person, this experience, this situation, this should not be happening in reality, right? We have an aversion to it. And one of the ways we often deal with these types of negative, things that we perceive as negative, is we get what? Irritated, frustrated, angry, enraged. Is that clear? It is the opposite of what can flow on the side of attraction. On the side of attraction, we get into craving, desiring, needing, wanting. And that disturbs our equanimity. And on this side, we get into rage, anger, irritation, acute, different ways. And that, again, incredibly disturbing to what? To calmness of mind, to unity of mind, to harmony in relationships. These first five are called the five hindrances. They are considered stronger, more unsettling, greater hindrances. They're kind of just bigger in their function, in their capacity to destroy one's capability of living a life of goodness, harmony, understanding, compassion, peace. These first five hindrances. Now, in a translation, Thai has six, and his translation has six and seven. Sometimes they're both together. But it's called desire for the worlds of form, desire for the formless worlds. So that's what that means is whether one just wants wants to let's say is looking for happiness somewhere else. That's probably one way to put it. And whether you're looking for happiness in another geographic place, geographic place, a physical place, really, that's all considered a desire for happiness, peace of mind, but thinking that you'll get it in the world of form. Formless means, some kind of either going to heaven, some kind of abstract world, bodiless world or something. That's what they mean by formless world. Or, some kind of abstract world, or even we could even almost say, like we were saying yesterday, to escape to some trance state or some blissed out state, right, as an escape, some drug-induced state. All these things would be examples of having a desire to achieve happiness. In a world of form, or in a formless world. Again, why is this a hindrance? Because where are we going to be putting our energies? We're not going to be putting our energies into the practice of living in the present moment, of looking deeply, of paying attention to the to forms, feelings, perceptions, mental events. We're not going to be doing it. We're going to be putting all our energy into material things, material stability, material gain. And we'll not be putting our energy into where it could be most beneficial. Is it considered a significant hindrance to our spiritual development? Because it takes away time and energy, and it puts it into pursuits that do not promise true happiness, because they are based on getting something, getting somewhere. In our tradition, we say what? In this moment, with this death, I have arrived. I am home. Right now. I have arrived. Right now, I am home. This is my home, the present moment. Awareness is my home. This is my home. And there's nothing that's stopping me from arriving there right this minute. Right? Nothing. But if I think my home is, some retirement community in the Sunbelt, and I'm putting a lot of my energy to get there. We may be disappointed when we arrive there. Initially, we'll be happy because we've achieved our goal. But soon enough, we'll find out not everybody is happy in Albuquerque. How could that be? I thought Albuquerque was happiness. And over time, I'm not so happy either. I'm still subject to sickness, old age, and death, and change, and impermanence, and sort of like that. Pride. Sometimes translated as arrogance. We can't talk about that's the superiority complex. I'm special. Look at me. Let me tell you my story. Let me tell you what I've done. Let me tell you who I am. Me. Can't get a word in edgewise with some of these people, right? I want to tell you about them and their life. We don't have interest outside of it. I really have an interest in you. How are you? How are you doing? What's going on in your life? The arrogant person is just interested in themselves. I'm letting everybody know about that. So again, it builds up self. I know better than everybody else. My beliefs are better than everybody else. I'm right, you're wrong. doesn't mean to say you can't have beliefs, views, you can't have a life, but, am I really smarter than everyone? Are my values better than everyone? Are my beliefs truer than everybody else? If I suggested that, you'd say, it's pretty arrogant. Wouldn't you? Yeah, for good reason. Again, inferiority complex. It doesn't mean, I'm just a nobody, I'm just an idiot, I don't have any beliefs, I can't have any views on anything, I can't speak up for myself, I can't. Well, that's just the I who sees itself as the opposite. That's also as that can be as strong an ego state as the arrogant state. The arrogant person always wants to be on top. The inferior person always wants to be on the bottom. Oh, let me be last. The arrogant person wants to get the front of the line. The inferior wants to be in the back of the line. And they're both what's attached. Right? So somebody gets in front of the person who's the end of the line and say, oh, no, you get in front of me. I want to be in the back of the line. This is my place. The inferior position. Again, it is different than selflessness. Selflessness is, you see somebody doing that. If you're obviously that hungry, it's not a big deal. You see what I'm saying? It comes from selflessness. It doesn't come from, you're more worthy than me. Just because you're not attached. No big deal. If I don't get any brownies, if other people get the brownies and they're happy, God love them. One of the antidotes to arrogance is the third immeasurable, taking joy in the joy of others. The arrogant person is only about my joy. Everybody loves brownies. If it makes them happy, maybe they'll be happy. But we know the things that truly promote happiness. We're not fools. The Buddha has shown us the way. And if we are good students of his, we listen to him. We practice the four immeasurables. We practice the eightfold path. We look deeply at the ten hindrances. And if we see that we are still deeply rooted in them, we do our best to work on them. Number nine is agitation. Oftentimes, agitation also goes with sloth or laziness. And those are considered significant hindrances in terms of both general practice of the path, but also, more specifically, they're considered significant hindrances in meditation. I don't have time to go in there. It's worth a whole Dharma talk. But it is going back to the time of the Buddha, and I'm sure before the time of the Buddha, because already in India at the time of the Buddha there were a strong tradition of meditation. And anybody like ourselves who sits down to meditate know we have to deal with two things. Right? On the one hand, we can get restless. Right? The mind is just restless, the fact that it's stimulated, it's hard to settle it down. It disturbs our equanimity, our meditation, our concentration. On the other hand, torpidness, sleepiness, laziness is a little different than that. To not make an effort is laziness. Are again significant hindrances to our spiritual development, really to any development. I mean, if there's anything that we want to master, that we develop competencies, any kind of skill, craft, anything, sport. You know, there has to be some kind of consistent application. If we're always kind of freaked out and agitated sometimes, you know, that'll interfere with our training. Right? On the other hand, if we're just kind of lazy and we go about it lackadaisically and we're always making excuses. So any kind of training, maybe that's a better way of looking at it, to find that capacity to just, you know, find that middle ground of consistent and persistent application is the way. Again, just for time, I'm not going to go into it, but please understand those are also the kind of poles. And oftentimes in our practice, our meditation, we may swing. So sometimes people have difficulty finding the middle ground. To kind of, you know, there's a lot of activity and agitation and restlessness, and then when that slows down, they kind of go, whoop, sleepy. but in the Buddhist meditative tradition, you can Google this, you can get some text. It's well dealt with. We are not the first. You are not the first. I am not the first. Okay, but there are many antidotes for both. And the tenth is ignorance, such as calling a brownie. I mean, calling a piece of chocolate cake a brownie. That's just stupid, isn't it? And then having, you know, and then going through all that other stuff. There's an ignorance in Buddhism which is a capital I. That is the fundamental ignorance about reality. But it really translates on a day-to-day basis in ignorance about things such as what we talked about. Of ignorance of the law of change and impermanence. I don't get it. And yet it's happening right in front of me. I believe things are permanent. Well, that's ignorance. Buddhism, we say wisdom, is to see that there's no such thing as a self itself. Everything is made up of parts. Parts are made up of parts. Everything is conditioned by causes and conditions. Nothing is self-existent. You know, you keep breaking down the variables and after a while you realize everything is interconnected. Everything is present. Everything is interconnected. Nothing stands by itself. Whether a feeling, a thought, a person, an emotion, an experience, everything is like that. This is the truth of emptiness, shunyata. But if we don't see it, and we see a world of everything is self-existing, and everything is just the way it looks to me, I don't look deeply, right? We're ignorant. We display our ignorance all the time. Right? We develop some sort of projection about somebody else. There are this and there are that. Well, it's something that we project. And yet we think it's really true. And plus we really think it's them. And so we have all kinds of judgments and criticisms and evaluations about them. We pick out a few incidences or a few of this and we make a blanket judgment. There are this, there are that. It's ignorant. One, because it doesn't see the complexity of who that human being is. It doesn't see they have their good parts, they have their weak parts, they have their strong parts, you know what I mean? There's a great complexity. And often the truth is, we all know, we all have that experience, right? We get this whole mental picture about somebody, and we believe it's true, and then we sit down and talk with them, and what happens? So somehow, totally different unfolds. Okay? And all of a sudden, we have to set aside our ignorant view. So it's like, you know, to believe thoughts are real, is ignorance. To believe that things are permanent is ignorance. To mislabel things is ignorance. So lots of ignorance. A lot of us are ignorant about what makes happiness in life. You know, what makes life meaningful, or what creates joy. I mean, some of us yesterday we're totally convinced that chocolate cake masquerading as a brownie, was going to be a source of great happiness, fulfillment, and meaning. In that moment, the guy said, "Well, we're kind of ignorant, but we can learn." That's wonderful. We can learn. We can wise up. We're going to what time today? Okay. So those are the 10 hindrances. Again, you'll have no problem Googling the 10 hindrances, Buddhism 10 hindrances. You'll find lots of teachings on the 10 hindrances. Any text on the sutra will probably list them, but you can find teachings explaining about them. I don't know if in Thai's book, part of the Buddhist teaching, he's got the 1 and 2 and 5 and 7 of most of the basic Buddhist teachings. I can't remember whether he's got the 10 hindrances. But let us come back to the sutra. We're having another retreat. It'll be a 4-day retreat here in March. We also have a 6-month intensive going on, but I'll go into that. And my plan is at that retreat to continue teaching from the sutra and also to work on the next 2 tetrads, which deal with the mind and the objects of mind or mental events, etc., at that retreat. So we will have more time. So do you remember the Buddha talking about his Sangha? It's pure and good. Not a lot of prattle, not a lot of chat. This one both will talk. And he says, in it, the assembly, there are those who realize the fruit of our hardship. They've destroyed every root of affliction, laid aside every burden, and attained right understanding and emancipation. Another great line in another translation. He says, in the Sangha of bhikkhus, there are bhikkhus who are arahats with taints destroyed, who have lived the holy life, have done what had to be done. I think that's a great one. How many of us can say, many of us can say, I know what I need to do. Yeah, I know what I need to do. If I really want to be happy, I know what I need to do if I really want to be sincere in my practice of healing and transformation. I know what I really need to do to make my relationships work. I know what I need to do to become a more loving human being. Right? Most of us, we know what we need to do. So I think this is a great line. Done what had to be done. That's the only difference between them and us. The only difference between an arahant and us. We still have a to-do list. It's still on our transformation and healing is still on our to-do list. The arahant, they finish their to-do list. They don't have a to-do list anymore. It's been done. I was always very impressed by that line. Done what had to be done. For those of you who live in tyranny of your to-do list, learn from the bhikkhus. Okay. All right, so those are the arahats. There are also bhikkhus who have cut off the first 5 internal formations and have realized the fruit of never returning to the cycle of birth and death. So I'm not going to comment too much on it, but just I think it's just interesting for you to understand that in the Buddha's time, as he's looking at his community, okay, he's kind of going, well, there are the arahats. The 10 hindrances are no longer present. You know, they've done what needs to be done. Then the next level down, they've cut off the five, first five, which might mean that the second five are still present with them. Obviously, they're not too strongly present with them because these are developed beings. But he's saying they've cut off the first five. Then the next one down is the ones who've thrown off the first three, and they've realized the fruits of returning once more. They've cut off the roots of greed, hatred, and ignorance, and will only need to return to the cycle of birth and death one more time. And then there are those who've thrown off the three internal formations and attain this fruit of stream entry, coursing steadily in the awakened state. This is another thing I think is very meaningful to us. From where we stand, or where we sit as practitioners, in terms of our own spiritual evolution, we should at least have the goal in this life of being a stream enter. Much better a Buddha, much better a fully enlightened one for those, but to be a stream enter. Again, you know, in that thing about going like a river. This is the metaphor that I think is very meaningful. Right? Anybody ever gone? Well, I won't say white water rafting, but it's kind of, you know, like done the Ichidoki or Ichidoki or anything. Anybody done nice rafting on a nice river?
Tubing.
Or kayaking. But anyhow, when you get on a nice river, and you're just flowing along, maybe, you know, you're still paddling a little bit, but your paddling is mostly just to kind of keep it in the center and keep it moving because you have the current. You're moving along in the stream. You're no longer struggling. You're no longer going against the current. Anybody ever paddle against the current? Right? And nobody goes tubing against the current, do they? That would be ignorant. So this is, I think it's a very apt term in our spiritual development. We want to get to that place where there's enough stability, there's enough of the hindrances that can cut away, that our life, our practice, is flowing. You know, we're in the stream of the ancestral teachers. We're in the stream of Dharma. It's no longer a struggle. We no longer have to fight. We're no longer in and out, in the boat, out of the boat, and working hard, not working hard. It's a flow. There's enough understanding, there's enough calmness, there's enough wisdom, there's enough compassion. Things have settled down enough. Enough of the hindrances have been cut away or attenuated, and now there's a flow. That's called in Buddhism a stream entry. That's the first, in terms of stages of enlightenment, that's kind of the first to become a stream enter. And then you kind of move up, to the seventh time returning, more than the journal, or Arhat, the Bodhisattva Buddha. For those of you who like the idea of the hierarchy, kind of moving up the hierarchy, and so type A's in here, this is kind of let me leave that. I want to, and again, there's lots of things to do some Buddhist teachings on these. So he's saying, remember he says, first he talks generally about the community, and now he's beginning to enumerate. He says, you know, there are these arhats, then there are these other ones who've cut off enough across the first five, they're never coming back into the world of suffering. Then there are the next level of those who've cut off the three, so they're going to come back one more time, and then there are the stream entrants, they've kind of ameliorated the stuff enough that at least they're flowing on. And then he goes on. Again, the stream entrant coursing steadily to the awakened state. That's the stream you want to wait. You're coursing steadily to the awakened state. Then he goes on. Okay, let's take a look. There are those who practice, again, talking about the monks right there. And again, if you remember, if you looking at, as I said, Tai's Old Path White Clouds, where he says there are 3,000. If you remember, there was an initial, I don't know, let's say 1,500, not 1,000, who were in retreat with him. Then when he stayed the other month, the word went out and all these other ones. So now there's an assembly of 3,000 that he's been working with, guiding and teaching. And now he's, so, you know, everybody's not in touch with everybody else. So he's talking to everybody, and he's kind of saying, we have in our community, we have arhats, we have non-returners, we have once-returners, we have people who've cut off this affliction, we have people who've cut off that affliction. So first he enumerates that we have people who've attained significant progress. But then he goes on to say something I think is very interesting. There are those who practice the four establishments of mindfulness. There are those who practice the four right efforts, and those who practice the four bases of success. There are those who practice the five faculties, those who practice the five powers, those who practice the seven factors of awakening, and those who practice the Eightfold Path. There are those who practice loving kindness, and those who practice compassion, those who practice joy, and those who practice equanimity. There are those who practice the nine contemplations, and those who practice the observation of impermanence. There are also bhikkhus who are already practicing full awareness of breathing. And that ends section one. Section two now focuses on full awareness of breathing. But to me, what is so meaningful here, especially in terms of the development of Buddhism for the last 2,500 years, is the Buddha's sangha was not a mono-practice sangha. Everybody was not doing the same practice. Right? If you look at the way Buddhism developed, over here everybody's doing what? Zen koan work. Over here everybody's doing Vipassana. Everybody here isn't going to. And I'm not saying anything negative. I'm just saying it's just interesting. Everybody's over here doing this. And over here the Thich Nhat Hanh people are doing the Thich Nhat Hanh stuff. And over here the Pure Land people are just doing it, you know? Right? Mm-hmm. And yet at the time of the Buddha, if we can believe this is true, he gave to his community the full breadth of his teachings. And people were, within the same practice community, practicing different things. Right? I mean, to me, this is very enlightening in terms of how the Buddha taught and the kind of openness and the creativity and originality that he not I wouldn't say allowed, cultivated. And we know I think Thich Nhat Hanh, if you look to the charter in the Order of Interbeing, for those who have that book, Interbeing, and you look in the back of the charter and you read the first couple of sections, you see a very clear expression of this. It's also, manifested in what's called the teachings of Upaya, skillful means, which means the Buddha is always giving teachings that are both appropriate for the person, but also skillful in terms of their own helping them develop. Right? So he might say to this one, you go practice full awareness of the breath. You go practice single point of concentration on a stone. You go practice loving kindness. You need to practice really focus on diligence and energy. You need to go to the charnel grounds and do the nine contemplations on corpses because you have attachments right here. So I think if we can imagine that when he's enunciating that this one's doing this and this one's doing that and this one's doing this, since he was, this is when he was still alive, right? And he was the primary teacher. We could imagine that the reason all these different monks are doing the different practices is because he's given them these different practices. So, as I say, when I read that, I find it very intriguing and very meaningful. Because it has always been my sense that the Buddha taught a holistic Dharma. That looked at the full complexity of what it means to be a human being, and he developed all kinds of specific kinds of practices and teachings to help here, to help there, to help the mind, to help the heart, to help the concentration, to build the wisdom, intelligence, patience, you know, energy. He had many different practices to deal with the full complexity of what it means to be a human being, but also to notice that some people are strong here and some people are weak here. Mm-hmm. So somebody over here may have very strong meditation, be very good at single point concentration, developing blissful states, you know, but they're very arrogant. So we need to work on practices that help deal with their arrogance. They may have to deal with practices of developing compassion, understanding for other people. They may have to deal with practices that help them look more deeply at their self, their illusory self, that they are so proud of. So again, I only say that if we can take, and what it's interesting with Thich Nhat Hanh, of course, because again, most of us, probably the Asian Buddhist system is probably Vietnamese Buddhism is probably a kind of Asian system that we, those of us in the West, know very little about. You know, there's been much more written about Japanese Buddhism, Korean Buddhism, Chinese Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism, especially often Theravada Buddhism in the Thai. Kind of, there's just a lot of literature out there, both by scholars and practitioners in the West, but also scholars or whatever within their own tradition that have written about them and have been translated, whatever. There's very little, as far as I know, about the Vietnamese tradition. But practicing in the Mahayana, practicing in Zen, you never hear about the Anapanasati Sutra. It's considered an early teaching of the Buddha. It's a Theravada teaching. It's really never discussed or taught about. And I think time it's either in this book or the Rosenberg book, I think they mentioned that. Even in lots of the Theravada countries, it's unknown. So it's very interesting that one of the things that Thich Nhat Hanh has done as primarily a Zen Mahayanist has really gone out of his way to explore these earliest teachings of the Buddha and to really... I think maybe at the end in one of his appendix he has a strong essay where he really strongly suggests that Zen people and Mahayanas really go back to their roots and bring this sutra and the Four Foundations, the Mindfulness Sutra, back into the tradition, because he believes this is the foundation of the Buddhist meditative traditions from which Zen and other Mahayana teachings developed. Which is one of the reasons in the Theravada Community Mindfulness this year we're devoting ourselves to the study and practice of this sutra. Everything comes to an end. Dharma talks come to an end. Books come to an end. Cups of tea come to an end. So now we've come to the end of our Dharma talk, our formal teaching. In a few minutes, we will have our closing circle. So, shall we take we'll do our bows, and then we'll take a 5-minute break, stretch bathroom break. We'll set up like we do for deep listening, deep sharing, and then we will have our closing circle. Is there anything else that we need to? Please, keep noble silence.